Welcome to the Endurance Podcast. My name is Tim, and I'm really happy to be joined today with a new co-host, Alex Rhodes. He's an athlete, a coach, and many other things. So I will let him introduce himself. We go a long time. So we've known each other for a long time now. And I'm really happy to be joined by him. But I will just let him introduce himself.
Thanks, Tim, and thank you for welcoming me onto the podcast. I guess in brief, before we discuss things a bit further, first and foremost, you mentioned that I'm a triathlon and cycling coach. I've been coaching well over 10 years and have worked up through what would be the highest level of coaching accreditation through our national federation. I've also competed for I would say what feels, well, I've been involved in sport for what feels like a lifetime, but I've been competing particularly in endurance sports over the past 10, 15 years. And alongside that, more recently, I studying my PhD, and I'm looking in particular at cellular metabolism and some of the influences between contraction and insulin glucose uptake in the muscle. So I have plenty to keep me busy. Alongside that, a bit about myself. I have two kids, which keep me even more busy. And a little bit of an addiction to coffee, which we can probably talk about a bit later as well.
How many coffees did you have today? Let's start with coffee.
Today was a difficult day. I'm 3 double espressos in, but that's two is kind of the norm. But it's a particularly tiring weekend with racing and things like that. So it was a 3 coffee day today.
I think we have to do a coffee episode in the future.
I think so. I mean, if you look at the culture of cycling and everything else, you know, coffee has just been a primary part of it alongside the ergogenic aid of caffeine. So I would be more than happy to do a podcast just on coffee.
Yeah, definitely. I think like this is a topic that's a really good one and a really exciting one, because I'm also into the coffee and
I think the dangerous thing is when you get down the wormholes of coffee and trying to produce good coffee, you just get lost in it, and you see, and it kind of spoils any other coffee for you when you go different places. So yeah, but I enjoy it.
So you mentioned you've been an athlete for ages, and one of the things that keeps being interesting to me is that the Xterra that you've been and competing in also involves in the winter cross-country skiing. How much cross-country skiing can you do in the UK, and how did you manage to be an athlete?
Well, without going too far back, I find myself in the world of Xterra Triathlon, which is, for people who are not familiar with it, it's basically normal triathlon but cross-country. So we swim in lakes and seas and things, and then cross-country mountain bike, and then trail running. So it's a little bit more on the extreme side of things. But I think it was probably 5 or 6 years ago, I was looking for some events. I used to race cyclocross over the winter, but I was just looking for something that would kind of give me some motivation and I wouldn't say something to do over the winter, but kind of split that season up because of the way they were. And I just find myself coming across winter triathlon, which is you start off with cross country running, you then mountain bike on what is usually piste, but in some cases it can be a bit muddy, a mixture of kind of traditional cross-country mountain biking, and then you'd finish with cross-country ski. So that kind of made me excited. At that point in time, I'd done quite very little cross-country skiing, and I took it upon myself as it was mainly part of trying to do some things over the winter that were cross, kind of cross training, and split that training dynamic up to keep things fresh for the season. And I know a lot of the Nordic, the Scandinavian nations, Denmark, Sweden, some of those athletes spend a lot of time cross country skiing over the winter because of the aerobic development. And what they found as well was that there was very little drop off in their cycling, for example, over that time. So that was kind of became a thing for doing it in the winter, and I decided to give this sport a go, and it turned out it worked out all right. But
did you ever
probably one of the hardest sports I've done.
But did you ever cross country ski in the UK, or was it always in mainland Europe?
It was always in mainland Europe. We do. The funny thing is, we've got a couple of biathletes and cross country skiers who race for Great Britain. But you've got to. There are some places in the season up in like Scotland and places which are accessible. But I live in the south of the UK, and it's actually quicker for me to drive to the Alps than it is to get to Scotland because of the roads. So it was a bit like, well, I can either go down to, you know, like the Chamonix region and the Alps, or I could go up to Scotland where the weather's really bad. You might not get good snow and it take the same amount of time. So yeah, I just started every season in the winter going on, it was almost like on vacation, but I go cross-country ski for a few weeks. And what a lot of people do and cross-country skiers do over the summer is roller skiing. So you know, basically shortened skis with wheels on, which you can work on your technique and your fitness as well. So kind of when my season finished for Xterra in the summer, I would get on the roller skis and try and
do okay.
Yeah.
Oh dear. I am scared to ride my bike on these roads here. And
you have to find certain places that, yeah, I wouldn't just go on the roads. Like I've been in South Germany and Austria, and it's fine to go on the roads on roller skis, but because it's quiet and the road quality is good. But certainly in the UK, you have to, I coach some people now who go to go-kart tracks and things like that, because it's a nice smooth surface. There's no traffic and there's a bit of consistency in doing that kind of work. And in fact, in one of the central parks in London, there is probably one of the UK's main ski clubs, where they have a huge, I think it's based in Regent's Park, where there's like a big cycle track around the park. And yeah, they do lots there. So you kind of just got to make do with what it is. And it was super hard going and competing against, you know, Italians, Slovenians, Russians who have been skiing since they were 5 years old. But yeah.
Oh dear. I mean, like, this could also be another episode, the road qualities, because like here in the UK, I don't know, like like I've spent the last few week googling on how the British roads are actually built, because I feel like they're so rubbish.
Yeah, they don't last very long, do they?
I mean, we had a lot of rain over the last few weeks. I don't know how it is down south. I guess you're souther, more south than me. But like here in Birmingham, it was just like everything was flooded. And on the top of the, let's call it hill, it was a flood on the road. And I was like, well, how the heck did you build this road so that you have a flood on the top of the hill?
Well, welcome to England.
It's just like...
It's character building, Tim. That's what You know, so then when you go race in Europe and it's nice roads and it's nice weather, then yeah, you're, or even if you do, if it does rain, you're going to be much more acclimatized to it than your competitors.
I mean, you can look at the Paris-Nice race and other races. It was raining, but it's still not the same, I think. You also worked as a nutritionist. Because you just talked about coaching and but nutrition, do you still do that or?
Yeah, so obviously not to a degree of your expertise, but I've studied it over the past 5 years through kind of postgrad level, and some of it related into I did a master's in research after that with nutritional aspects. So it was mainly an avenue that was of big interest to me. I had been coaching a long time, and I actually started pursuing it as just, let's say, extracurricular. It was something that I was interested in and wanted to be educated more on it to complement the work with the athletes that I did and understand how to, work from a more rounded perspective with some of those athletes. And it kind of escalated from there, and I continued it really. So my primary thing is, it still is coaching from that, but I do provide that nutritional aspect to it as more of a, I would say, a specialism, but it's something that I would do. Whereas we have other coaches that are a bit more inclined to look at the strength and conditioning side and things like that. So that kind of specificity is something that I provide as part of my coaching as well.
So because you're researching in the field of metabolism, so you're very close to nutrition. What would you say are still the biggest mistakes that your clients do in terms of nutrition, how your scientific knowledge informs you on what to then prescribe the athletes, or what would you say are the biggest misconceptions that people still assume are true?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, and some of the work that I do from a research perspective is probably a little bit less applied, let's say, when we look at cell signaling and things like that, but it helps you understand metabolism in general. And I think the fact of working with athletes for a long time prior to that has just gained insight to look at what those people are doing, understand how to review things critically, research information and media. And we know the media is crazy at the minute, but being able to cross over to the applied side is really nice. And I think from my perspective, a lot of the athletes that I work with are relatively longer endurance athletes. We might have some that do kind of 70.3s and full distance triathlons. And really just, I wouldn't say some of the basics, but the preparation into it, I think it's quite common or a bit more understood now that we know carbohydrate intakes have increased over time. And there's a little bit more research and practical application that has established itself. But I often find people in their preparation, so things like cutting fiber out prior to races and things like that, and there still is a lot there. Well, what do you have prior to your events and things like that? Well, I have lots of porridge and things like that, and you're like, well, there's still quite a lot of fiber in that. And I think there's a perception of, well, it's a lot of carbohydrates, but we don't think about some of the other things that might come into play during that event and in the preparation of it and how much we perhaps need in order to load the glycogen. So I do find some of that. People are a bit more educated on what they're having and a bit more purposeful about what they're having during events. But actually the other stuff in and around that event and how you prepare for it in the coming days, I think those are some things that are not quite up to speed with where things are at.
Yeah, just like I have this feeling that at the moment, like when it comes to like on the race nutrition, it's kind of everyone knows, yeah, we need carbs, like, and especially in triathlon, people are going with massive amount of carbohydrates just because they can tolerate them. And I don't want to go into the details of why I think it's not necessary to go with 180 grams per hour, but like then the next time when you talk to them, they would be like, yeah, but before the days before the event, we don't want simple carbohydrates because this will spike the insulin and everyone is scared about the insulin. This is going to be like, I don't know, just like next day you have diabetes type 2 and then in 3 days you have diabetes type 1 probably. And it's just like you want to avoid insulin spikes. And then so I'm like, well, you need to glycogen load with like a simple carbohydrates, not like massive amounts of fiber, but also salt. Like you see people like, yeah, carbohydrate loading with, yeah, fat, fiber and salty foods. And then you're like, people feel sluggish on the day of the event and they're like, yeah, glycogen loading didn't work. Yeah, obviously it didn't work because you were just like eating everything you didn't need to. I don't know how you feel about this.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that's some of the thing, like I was just saying, I think that's some of the things that I end up working with a bit more with athletes as opposed to what they're taking during. And yeah, there are occasions where people are just not accustomed to taking the amount of carbohydrates that we want to, but people are usually on board and usually a bit more clued up in doing that. But yeah, like you say, understanding what foods we should be eating prior, and like you say, the composition, not just, well, all right, we know porridge oats has carbohydrates in, but it also has a lot of fiber and it has some fat. So is that really the best option prior to, you know, an event that might last 9 to 15 hours? And then there's some of the things about what people are having for those kind of longer endurance events. And people tend to want, well, I can't stand gels for that period of time, or I can't stand this, so I need some solid food. And then what I commonly see and then have to work with is, well, we have oat bars and things like this. And it's a bit like, well, that is also not going to help, even though it's carbohydrates. But again, we're, you know, looking at fiber and fat content and things like that. We might feel a lot more comfortable if we went down a different avenue. So yeah, I wouldn't say they're basics, but some of those key principles in what we're eating and what the composition of that food is what I see a lot, rather than saying, you know, right, we need to hit 60 grams an hour, or we need to hit 90 grams an hour, or, you know, 120. Then I think people are a bit like, okay, yeah, I can do that. But actually what that looks like in terms of real food is probably the key area that I find myself working with people on over the past few years.
I had the other day, I was giving a talk to a Slovenian cycling lab about sports nutrition. And it was basically like, it's really amusing to me. And there were like cyclists, and then there were like the club officials there. And I was telling the riders, yeah, you need carbohydrates before, during, and like loads of like simple carbs. And then these old people, they were just telling me, like, in the end, prepared to argue with me that you don't need these carbs. This will make you like insulin resistant, and in the long term will impair the health, and that they really care about the health of their riders. And I was, well, like, the world's best cyclists are doing that. Yeah, but nobody cares about their health. and it was just like, you know, and I was like, come on, is it better to be in energy deficiency, or is it actually better to be eating what you need on the day or in the days before? So that when you finish the race, you're basically not as destroyed as you would have been had you had, like, high fat, I don't know, healthy meals. And it's just like these misconceptions are so funny to me. And I'm just like, come on.
And it's funny, isn't it? I think what people don't necessarily understand in the general public, and this is kind of one of my, I wouldn't say my go-to things, but a thing that I like to think about is everything has context. And it is the context of what you're doing and what you're having. And there's a great, it was a couple of weeks ago, there's a great infographic by Asker Jukendrup on two pathways, basically, of, you know, if you eat certain foods, high fructose, even just high sugar in general, but you're sedentary and you have a calorie surplus, then we might face issues with metabolism and type 2 diabetes and things like that for the very sedentary people. But then flip it on the other side to someone who's perhaps, training 2-3 hours a day or, 10, 12 hours a week, is not likely to be in a calorie surplus. And actually, like you say, energy deficiency is probably going to be more catastrophic than them having these things. And we know as well, during contraction about insulin stimulation and it doesn't really exist during contraction. So I think some of these misconceptions are lacking in context. And what we often see in the media is without that context, and people just get a little bit scared by some of the recommendations without really analyzing it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, and I feel like this public message from public health perspective that we need to avoid eating sugars is just not helping in this regard. So we have like very like polarized, the nutrition should be really polarized in terms of like, oh, athletes, they are at risk of low energy availability, so they need like these fast sugars. But then on the other hand, like 99% of sedentary people, yes, for you, it's probably not good to eat this sugars or gels when you are like sitting in the office or even in the car, being a director sportif of a cycling team. Like, no?
Yeah, I totally agree.
So... I hope we can in the future go into topics like this and discuss them, perhaps offer some more mechanistic background on and explanations on why insulin or sugars are not that bad for health. Perhaps this could be one of the next topics.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Because I know that you perhaps or probably know more about these types of things than I do, because I'm so performance-oriented these days.
I'm not so sure about that.
Really happy to have you on board for the podcast, because I think we have some exciting topics to cover over the next months, probably hopefully years.
Yeah, I'm certainly looking forward to it. And I look forward to delving into just some of the guests and asking, getting some nice information, having some good discussions going forwards that will, be relevant for everyone out there, which I think is the important part of it, is to be able to help the listeners and provide information for their own performance.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the main message we want to put out, to educate. And so if like listeners have any questions, any wishes on what to discuss in the future, just like comment below and please let us know what you want to hear, and then we'll try to cover it in the next episodes.
Yeah.
Cool. It's a short episode. The first one with Alex, and hopefully next ones can be a bit more with more context and with more like a better agenda. Just to start up with a new co-host. Thanks a lot for everyone for listening.
And thank you for welcoming me on, and I look forward to some great discussions in the future.
Cool. See you in the next one.
See you soon.